When I decided to open a second location, the Brentwood Country Mart was the only place on earth I wanted to be. I'm Laura Vinroot-Poole from Capital, and this is What We Wore, the Brentwood Country Mart edition. Pippa Small is a captivating jewelry designer, and more importantly, a woman fiercely dedicated to empowering communities around the world, from Afghanistan to Rwanda to Colombia. I loved hearing the jingling of Pippa's layers of beautiful jewelry throughout our conversation and learning about the one piece she's never taken off. I can't remember where I first met you, and I was thinking, I know I met you in your store in London. I went specifically just to introduce myself to you. And I don't know if it's because of, would it have been Irene or I guess maybe Maria that said you have to go in the store?
Might have been Maria.
I think it was Maria. And Maria is the Maria, best taste, doesn't she? She's the best.
Yeah. It's like that shot Mookie Moot of hers is,
yes.
You sort of feel like she's seen everything in the world and she's chosen the best, and it's there curated in this way of, you know, the ultimate pair of jeans and the best soap in the way, you know, it's kind of that feeling in her shop. So yeah, I'm hugely complimented.
I am too. Well, and yeah, exactly. And it's the only place really, when I go to London, I shop there.
Other than the pedicure.
And then, yes, and also perfumerage. I don't know where you're from. Where are you from originally? I think you're from different places.
Yes, I was born in Montreal.
Ah, really?
And spent, I suppose, until I was five in kind of northern Quebec and Montreal. Mm-hmm. And then my mother got pneumonia and decided she needed to go to a dry, hot place. And
she should have tried Las Vegas.
Well, fortunately, she decided the south of Spain, where my aunt and family were living. So we moved there.
Okay.
And then...
Five until when?
Seven. Okay. And then we moved to England. And it was partly because my father was from Scotland originally. Mm-hmm. He was born in South America, but his family was from Edinburgh. He was born in 1901, I have to say. So I have a father who's he was older.
Yeah.
Considerably older.
I think my grandfather was born in 1901. Wow. Yeah.
That's interesting. Amazing. I mean, just to segue off into the weirdness of older parents, but it is interesting to have a father whose brothers died in the First World War.
Yeah.
And it connects you in the strangest way. Sort of a sense of history is very personal. You know, to me, this idea of, you know, the uncles that were in the Second World War, that, you know, it just feels so much closer. This kind of the sense of history that's through the family in this strange, distorted way that having older parents kind of gives you a... Anyway, that's...
Was your dad with you in Canada and in Spain?
Yes. So he was with us when we moved to England. So his thought was to move back to Scotland because Quebec at the time was going through the sort of separatist thing. And he thought, I'll go back to Scotland, but maybe not Scotland because it's too wet and I'll go to Wiltshire. So we ended up in Wiltshire of all places in the kind of, I don't know, what would that be, mid-70s or something? They bought this kind of beautiful house in the middle of the country and we had stables and like acres of garden and fields and it was magical. He promptly passed away, unfortunately, but my mother decided...
How old were you?
Eight. Eight, I think.
Wow.
And my mother decided to stay. So she kind of had this... England at that time, actually, I have to say, was quite in that rural area. It was quite unsophisticated. You know, there wasn't olive oil. There wasn't espresso coffee. It was very... kind of cut off. It was very farm horsey. That was the hunt. That was the primary occupation of most people, fox hunting. And she didn't really fit in as a kind of newly widowed and foreign and with three young children and three other children. And she kind of...
That was what I was going to ask is your dad was so much older. Did he have another family before?
Yeah, they both did.
And actually. So, really? Your mom too? Mm. So were you close to them?
Yeah, I was the youngest and the eldest would be old enough to be my father.
Wow. Oh, how amazing.
Kind of generational mix up again. So yes, she's decided to stay in this, you know, very foreign and rather exotic place in a way for her. But I don't think it was easy and it took her a while to find like-minded people. And she kind of met this bohemian set of sculptors and painters and landscape designers. And she slowly made this kind of world for herself.
Was she an artist?
She painted, yeah.
Even when you were little and always?
Huh. Yeah. In a way, it was an idyllic childhood because I had ponies, chickens, ducks, horses, cats, obviously, chinchillas, parrots, you know, huge houses full of animals, donkeys, just kind of, really idyllic. You know, it was free to roam. There weren't many young people around. So it was, you know, quite, you had to be quite resourceful and find your own things to do in this kind of beautiful, I don't know, little haven in the middle of the country. So I think it was heaven. My sisters and brothers, when they became teenagers, got a little frustrated, wanted to be in the city. And but for me, it was perfect. It was just heaven.
What was your mom's style like? You have such beautiful style.
She was born in New York, mm-hmm. also from kind of Scottish-Irish family. Uh-huh. But her mother in the late 1920s took her and her sister to Reno, Nevada to get a divorce from her husband who had disappeared. So she kind of came to get that kind of divorce thing and met a young cowboy, a man who was 13 years younger than her, and ended up marrying him. So my mother's stepfather was this young man from Reno, and they ended up living there for a while.
Wow.
In Nevada. So in the 20s and 30s. So again,
how interesting. Yeah. Okay. And so, and she had great style. I mean, her marriage style. I'm getting.
Well, then that was my grandmother. Then my mother married, and I think after the war, she married and moved to Canada.
Okay.
But her style, I would say, was the reason I mentioned Nevada is because I'd say her style was quite cowboy.
Really?
She wore jeans all the time and these kind of jodhpur boots and... Yeah, I wear jeans every day now and I wear boots also. So I think I might somehow be emulating her style. But she didn't really wear much jewelry. That's what I think.
Well, that's
cool.
What I was going to ask. What's your first jewelry memory?
Probably my aunt, her sister, mm-hmm. who was...
In Spain?
The one who lived in Spain. Yeah. But she actually lived everywhere from Iran to Colombia to Naples. She just spent her life having these kind of... I don't know, a fancy of wouldn't it be interesting to live on a lake in Switzerland? And she'd take all her children and off they'd go to Switzerland. And then it would be kind of something interesting. And she would go to San Francisco and then she would move to, I don't know, she lived everywhere. But she was that classic aunt with a turban, with big turquoise rings from Tehran, she just kind of was exactly that sort of Graham Greene aunt character.
Wow, I love. And do you remember loving the jewelry? I mean, did it
connect
for
you
then?
I loved the jewelry. Yeah, yeah.
She let you try it on.
Yes.
And,
as a child, I was running around with her.
And what was it like? I mean, moving around from country to country, not even city to city, just country to country. Yeah. I mean, that must have been hard to move schools and.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and but also I think interesting to have the step siblings or half siblings on the other side.
Yeah. Partly because it was such a big family and, you know, all big families have their troubles, obviously. That I think being the youngest of all these siblings and quite strong character siblings, that I was naturally really shy and really quiet. And that's why actually growing up in the country with all these animals was perfect for me, because I'd kind of sit in the chicken house and, you know, commune with my hen friends, and then I'd be off with my pony and walking with a dog and kind of avoiding all the dramas of many, many people having all their growing up issues. And
do you remember your first piece of jewelry? Or the first piece that was important to you?
I remember a piece that was given to me by my godfather, mm-hmm. and it was a beautiful gold bracelet. And I had a favorite hen, a chicken, and I gave it to her to wear.
As a necklace?
As a necklace.
And did she like it?
She did like it for a bit, and then it disappeared.
Oh my God, what was her name?
Oh God, she was called Henrietta. But yeah, there went the gold bracelet. I think everyone thought at that point, don't give her jewelry.
And are you Philippa?
I am Philippa.
You are Philippa.
Yeah.
And so then from Scotland, you went to university.
Then I went to university. Yeah, I went to London University, Goldsmiths first to do anthropology, and then School of Oriental and African Studies, so as to do a master's in medical anthropology.
And tell me what medical anthropology
completely
is.
Completely related to design.
I have, my sister is an anthropology major and my brother is a doctor, but I can't see. They don't
put them together.
Yeah, I don't really know how it works. Yeah, tell me.
Well, it was interesting because, I mean, the reason I did anthropology actually was because I was very lucky that my mother, this cowgirl mother with many children, I think when she was widowed for the second time, she just thought it's time for me to do the things I want to do. And so she wanted to travel. And it was an amazing experience to be taken from a really young age to places like I don't know, to Turkey, to India, to Tunisia. She'd hear about this camel festival in the desert in Tunisia, and we'd go.
Just you, or did she take everybody?
The three of us, three younger ones. Okay. Yeah, so my two siblings. And that I found absolutely transformative. I mean, I do find now when I have these lovely 9-year-old twins that people are always telling me, why are you taking them to, I don't know, South America or to India from 4 months onwards? I've been traveling with them.
Yeah.
And they kind of say they won't remember. Oh my God,
my mom says that all the time. And I'm like, what?
I know. It's like, I mean, it's what created
you.
I think, exactly. You know, I do believe that at some cellular level, you absorb that you may not consciously remember, but these things are all, I think it's really important for them to understand that the world is very large and very complicated and people live in very different ways. And it's important to see that and know that. And
you are not that important, right? I mean, kind of, I think a little bit
totally.
Of it, really.
Yeah.
And also just the ability to fit in anywhere and to figure it out and to not say, I'm sorry, they don't have chicken fingers here. I can't eat here. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You probably were not that sort of a child. No, I think it's one of the biggest gifts you could ever give your children.
I think it is and probably more and more important, you know, as we become, you know, in some senses we become more secluded into our bubbles, you know, remaining with like-minded people. And in other ways, the world is getting smaller. But unless we go and experience and feel and talk to people and have a sense of other lives, it's going to be dangerous, I think.
Yeah. And so the way you all traveled, I mean, sounds like your mom wanted to do really cool things when she got to these places too. So you really did, I'm sure, meet people.
Absolutely. I mean, she was luckily quite adventurous. So I just remember sort of early things like, you know, going to a farmer's market. You know, all these people would come down from the hills and they'd have their produce. And I just remember it would always be kind of, she'd look around and I'd be wandering off with a family, like, hey, I'm going to go back to their village with them and see. And they'd have me bundling up in the truck to go with them, or with the Maasai in Tanzania. I had family who lived in Tanzania and we'd kind of go a few times, and just, you know, fascinated to know going back to the village and going into the houses. And I mean, being a female child is quite useful because the women feel fine to bring you in the house.
Yes.
I just felt and always have felt completely fascinated and curious. How do other people live? What do they believe in? What motivates them? What does this mean to them? And what does the earth mean to them? What does food mean to them? What does family mean to them?
Well, and I also want to see how they literally live. Like, what does their bed look like?
Yeah.
What does their kitchen look like? I don't know. I love a train. I take a train as often as I can. And that's my favorite thing, is just try to look into people's, you know, houses on the train route.
Yeah.
Because you just are like, it's just so
fascinating. Yes, that's such a strange thing, isn't it? Going by, you see the illuminated rooms.
But I love it.
Yeah, you make up the stories of,
yes, I think that's it too, the stories and trying to understand. Yeah, that's so interesting. And so how did you connect that was, I mean, as a young person, did you know that was anthropology, basically?
No idea.
Yeah, so you started and you took a few classes and they were like, well, you should be an anthropology major.
Well, no, I think a friend of my sister's told me about it. I'd never heard of anthropology. And once I started looking into it, I was like, that's absolutely what I want to do. And by then I was already interested in human rights. So I was kind of already starting to, I think all that travel did help me to understand that there were, you know, people who were being rather unjustly treated and there was sort of situations going on that weren't right. And so I'd already had a sense of that from childhood. But I think then as I grew older, I became more interested and you know, discovered more acutely how things were. And university was just, from going to many schools, nine schools actually, which I was never very fond of, I got to university and loved it. I remember just feeling this kind of excitement, you know, after a lecture that just, you know, that sense of someone explaining why the world is the way it is. And you're just like, finally, all these things are, you know, it's like opening up your mind and having it stirred and thrown about. And then you're just like, I understand now why some countries are poor and some are rich. Why are some people, you know, just all began to make sense. And I was amazingly, I just remember coming home and, you know, gathering friends and saying, now let me tell you everything I learned today.
Really? Oh my God, I
just loved it.
Tell me about the medical anthropology part. What is that?
The medical. Well, I mean, medical anthropology, I was sort of torn between going into anthropology of the arts, which could lead to curating, collecting, museum work. You know, I thought that would be very interesting, or medical anthropology. And it was in part because, you know, there's sort of, like all big families, you know, there's some mental health issues in the family.
Sure.
And I was very interested
pathology,
yes. Yeah. A little madness.
I have some myself.
And I was interested in how mental health was seen in other cultures. Medical anthropology is simply medical systems, healing system, doctor-patient relations, ways of seeing the body, ways of understanding health, disease in other cultures,
or
in, you know, other cultures within our culture, or, you know, in migrant communities, or how other people see death and birth. And so it was a kind of, actually what was interesting was as a master's, there were a lot of mature students,
yes.
who were doctors or nurses from WHO, or who had worked in, you know, different conflict areas, and they had really interesting experiences to bring in actually back to, you know, students who hadn't done anything and like me. So it was really interesting, and they found it very useful to take away with them, you know, what are normal and abnormal forms of behavior in another culture context, or does psychoanalysis work in India, you know, with a different kind of family structure, or that kind of thing.
Oh, how fascinating.
Nothing to do with jewelry.
Yes. And so, well, were you making jewelry at this time at all?
Making jewelry? I think I did start. Yes, I had started at that point making, you know, I mean, drilling my first drill. So everything I could find and put a hole in, you know, seashells.
Yes,
and
yeah.
I got a diamond drill so I could do stones. So every bowl I still have has little holes in it from that I put water in and then drill through to keep the diamond from overheating. And
that was not your goal?
No. Really not.
And so next, so from university you went to, I think you went to Borneo for the first time. And tell me about that.
I went because I had some, through different NGOs I was involved with in London, I'd heard about, there was a particular issue in Sarawak at the time of a very large dam that was being planned called the Bakun Dam. And it would involve flooding a massive area. And they were keen to know what people in those communities felt about the dam. Were they happy to move? Was it something they were going to be kind of financially compensated for? Or was it something they were desperately against? Or they wanted a sense of that. So that gave me, I was doing a thesis, but it also gave me a kind of another reason to go. And I think that was one of the, I'd been traveling a lot on my own before that, but that was quite a life-changing trip because I was spending time in kind of deep rainforest, which was amazing. I was spending time with nomadic hunter-gatherers, which was utterly, still the most incredible experience I've ever had, that period with them. And just getting to understand, I mean, the struggles of small communities against massive development projects of, you know, logging and oil palm plantations, but also things about indigenous, you know, medical systems, what plants, traditional plants they would use for healing, how to preserve those plants, language, how to keep their traditional languages alive for the grandparents to teach the young, and despite pressure of kind of national governments to lose those languages. So there were many things going on that I found really fascinating, mostly done by women, indigenous women, kind of bravely. And that was sort of, yes, that was a life-changing moment because I felt like this was a movement that was to do with environment, to do with human rights, to do with women, to do with nature, to do with kind of everything that's important. And it was all in one kind of fight, really. And so that was quite a moment where I just suddenly felt like, this is it. This is what's worth, you know, fighting and living for. This is something huge.
And how long were you there?
On and off for quite a few years. Like, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years. I'd go back and forth and do things. So I'd spend sort of a few months and then I ended up going from there to work with another group in Thailand and then
Botswana?
And then Botswana. Botswana came later,
This is it's not a shallow question because it's actually your job, but but when did you start noticing jewelry? Was that sort of always a part of it?
Well, jewelry was always a part. I mean, the reason I started with my drill was because I had, I think as many children do, this fascination with stones. Like, I don't know, just always picking up. I mean, I think most people pick up stones everywhere they go, but stones were, I don't know, maybe because the chaos of family life, that stones felt very solid and still and dependable and kind of, I don't know, ancient and quiet and wise.
Yeah.
And
wise, know, for wise, sure.
Something
yes.
about them.
Yeah.
I mean, hard to say, but it was the touch of them. And I'd always have them in my pockets.
Really?
I'd always be losing them. I'd put them in bed, in the bath. I was just stones
That's
everywhere.
So funny.
And the drilling was so I didn't lose them.
Oh my God,
it was literally so I could carry them around on a chain, or as I still do, on cords, and not lose them. So that was kind of the beginning of making jewelry, was to have my pebbles. And Botswana was the first trip I did, which was very definitely going to be about craft and making things. So it was, gosh, it must be like 23 years ago or something, or maybe more. And I knew I was going to go to make jewelry and embroidery and leatherwork. And it was just at this time where I had this sort of thought that maybe in making jewelry and in having lived with different communities, it was a way of combining. Because wherever I go, even Sarawak and Borneo, where people would come and say, "Well, do you think you can get our baskets, sell our baskets? Can you sell these bracelets?" You know, they would always be trying to make things, which they did beautifully and could do, but they didn't have a market. And then I'd take all the baskets and try and sell them.
Right.
And it would be kind of, well, maybe if they're bigger, or if the color was different, or if the beads were different color. And so I just thought, they have the skills and the resources, and they need the work, and they need the money, and they need the pride of making beautiful things. And I just kind of, it dawned on me that if they made, particularly in Botswana, if they perhaps spent more time and made something really with kind of intent for it to be a beautiful, important thing, and not a kind of cheap, rapidly made, breakable thing, but something that's going to be in the world for a long time, then that would kind of change. They could charge more money for it, and it could become something that to be proud of, rather than something made very quickly for a sort of tourist market.
Right. But so, they just didn't have the ability or the understanding of how to get it to the place where
markets,
you could sell it.
Exactly.
For that. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. And local tourist markets are a little sort of less interested in the, you know, it's just about a souvenir and it's kind of pick up
last minute.
And,
yeah.
So it was just really trying to shift it. Let's make something. If we're going to spend time and use energy and use materials from the world, let's make them beautiful and last and be important and precious. So that was the first trip I started to do that with the community of women.
And what was it like? Was it challenging?
I did it one summer, and I found it very challenging because HIV/AIDS was unfortunately huge in the community. So there were frequent funerals, and poverty was an issue. And it was very interesting because that first trip I spent, I don't know, maybe 6 weeks, and I found it quite difficult. And then I went back a year later to do it again over the same period in the summer, and it was completely the opposite. It was as if, I think they also felt a bit like, okay, you've come back, you know. So I think the coming back was really important because it made me understand, actually, you know, not seeing, just seeing the other side, which was this incredible community of extraordinary people who survive in this amazing desert, you know, through just ingenuity and brilliance, and the struggles they have now with the loss of, you know, land and hunting rights and so forth. But to see what they made, and to see what joy and, you know, laughter and just constant laughter. I mean, we'd sort of, all the women, we'd sit outside, we'd be making things and endless laughter. You know, someone would say something, big roars, that someone would start dancing, someone would start singing. It was just kind of seeing the complete reverse of that first time that I found. I was seeing the kind of the darker side, and this time it was just the joy. And that kind of created I don't know, a love of being in places when you have purpose, and not just traveling through, but sort of stopping and staying still and putting down even the most temporary roots. That sort of, but having that relationship with people that's based on an exchange or a creative, especially creating, you have that language in common. And
Pippa, does every culture create adornment, or do they? Does every culture do that?
Everywhere. Yeah.
Clothing and jewelry and makeup, I guess.
Yeah.
And hair.
Yeah.
All the things. For me, it's food also. It is embroidery, but it's also food that I'm amazed how similar it is across the world.
Yeah.
You know, that it's maybe, you know, maybe people, these people have maize and these people have rice, but really the dish is pretty much the same.
Totally. I mean, those are all kind of human creations. I mean, all of it. Last summer I went to Lascaux in France to see the caves of the prehistoric caves, and to see what I found beautiful was, I mean, 27 to 30,000 years ago, the two things that humans made at that point were the needle for sewing, so skins would be stitched, and jewelry, and that was it. You know, no pottery, no metalwork, but horn, bone, stone, whatever it was, those were the needle were the two most important things for thousands of years, not for kind of a short period. That was it. Jewelry for obviously so important, so intrinsic to us as humans.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
I think it's the connection to it's a quite animistic thing. It's this connection to nature, to whether it's to animal or to plant or to rock. I think it just brings those natural forces or energies that we just kind of are in tune with, but, you know, we use as protection, really.
Yeah.
To enhance, to make us brave, beautiful.
Yeah.
It's the same as we do now, I guess.
So when did jewelry become full time, or when did you feel like you could do that? How did it even cross your mind, actually?
Well, I really, since I was young, I wanted to write. I thought I would be a writer. And then I thought, when I started going to Borneo and things, I thought to make documentaries, because I thought this is such a fascinating story. And I thought, this needs to be told. People need to see what, these people are doing and how they're fighting and, incredible things. But I did neither of those. And the making of jewelry, which, as I said, I did from kind of childhood, when that kind of, I don't really remember, but I know that I would make things for myself, and it would be one of those, well, would you make me a bracelet like yours? And right. Then another person, then a shop would ask for it. And it just slowly began kind of seeping in, and I'd sort of make a few things and sell them or give them to a shop, and then I'd think, okay, now I'm I'm off again to Africa or Asia, and just kept reappearing. And I think sometimes in life there is perhaps a destiny, and you kind of fight it by going off to the left and the right, but actually you're brought back to that path again. And certainly in my case, I'd literally be off around the world and then I'd come back and the jewelry was still there. And I think it was just in traveling and seeing all these other peoples and wearing jewelry and using different materials and having different beliefs around that jewelry that I just thought, well, yes, I have those same beliefs actually. And I love making, love wearing, love appreciating. So I don't know, that kind of, the shop or two which grew, and it just seemed to, the demand was there, and I just would start.
It's also about you. I think the way you wear jewelry is so unusual and so attractive, and truly like attracting. Like, I'm sure people stop you all over the world, don't they?
Yeah.
And did they then? You had already been making.
I was already dressing. Yeah, I was already wearing a lot of jewelry.
I think that probably was part of it too.
Probably something.
You probably couldn't walk down the street without people saying, "Oh my God, where did you get that? Who made that?"
Yeah.
So what did your mom think?
I remember she was quite, not disappointed, but it was a bit like, so you're going to, just after, this education and all this experience traveling, you're going to just make jewelry. It was just a little bit of a kind of, there was definitely a sense of, that's it?
This is it?
What about, she thought I should work in conservation and work, it was like, oh. But I think when I kind of moved it to working more with communities, then for her it was like, okay, all right.
When did you figure out that it could be about empowering communities?
In India, I met a woman called Kathy Park, who worked with Christina Kim from DOSA. Yeah. And we met in Jaipur, and I think what Christina Kim was doing with DOSA was so inspirational, so interesting and so exciting. And so beautiful. And what she was doing with fashion and textiles was the same as what I try and do with jewelry. It's just, it's taking this incredible knowledge and explaining to people. I remember when she was doing her wholesale and things, and her explaining to clients or her team about, the history of this dye or this technique of pleating or whatever it was.
Exactly.
And it was so fascinating. And I think that kind of seeing that there could be an appreciation that,
that there could be storytelling around
storytelling,
it, really.
Exactly. And that sort of difficult area between, those scary words like cultural appropriation, which, I think can be quite intimidating, make you feel a bit powerless. But when you say, I truly believe that, working in Afghanistan with Afghan artisans, I think it's really important to me that the work we're making is drawn from their culture, from their traditions,
exactly.
Region. I think it would be kind of more disrespectful to come and say, I want you to make this.
Here's how the English like it.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of, this is what's in trend at the moment, this
oh my
season,
God, what
today.
What a nightmare. Can you imagine how?
ear clips and that's it. And, oh God. I mean, it's sort of, it seems to me you should have the respect to the artisan to make it about their language.
Gifts.
Yeah. The materials they use and their techniques.
And their history.
And their history, yeah.
How do you make it so it's about partnering with the communities rather than charity?
Well, I think the first few ones were kind of charity. And then I did, it was a sense of, if we want this to be sustainable, and I use that word very carefully because I get a little nervous when people use it about jewelry in terms of materials, are obviously not sustainable,
right.
clearly. But I think jobs are sustainable in the sense, if you can employ someone for decades, this is a really important thing.
And generations.
In the long run, I wanted this to kind of last. And now in Afghanistan, we've worked together for since 2008. And I'm really proud that some of the people in the workshop were really young when they started. And now they have children. And it's kind of, that job is such an important, you know, I think emphasizing how vital livelihoods are in places where there's such vulnerability through conflict, through poverty, through, you know, violence, whatever it happens to be. Jobs are everything. And creative jobs are even more important, because it means people leave the workshop feeling, I've achieved something today. I've made something beautiful. It's going out into the world. I may not be able to, but this thing is going out into the world. And it's kind of, to me, it's a bit their voice and their hand is coming telling their story. And I think it's, I mean, a lot of the time I find myself in workshops, you know, we discuss designs, we discuss stones, we discuss materials, we discuss the kind of inspiration behind the design. But most of the time I find myself just listening. Mm. You know, there's stories that everyone, you know, especially when you're an outsider and it's in a place where it's not as accessible, it's quite cut off. And you kind of end up listening. Everyone wants to tell you what their experience has been, whether it's been... Wow. You know, there's been a bomb and they, you know, about this morning when they couldn't get to their child and they knew that area had been closed off and their child was at school, and or what it's like when, you know, you're going to work and suddenly the city's extra quiet and you know that's a sign something's going to happen, and you jump off the bus and you, you know, kind of try and get somewhere. So it just kind of, they all wanted to explain what their life is like, what their reality is like, just to kind of share. And I think it's, you know, that role of listening is really important, just to understand what their daily reality is, and whether that's Afghanistan or Myanmar or in Jordan, where, you know, we work with young women who are refugees from Syria, particularly, and Palestine and things, is just to listen and be that kind of, you know, vessel for their stories. And I feel those stories go into my belief is they go into the jewelry. I think, you know, when you're making something in an area where you're selling it in Notting Hill in London or in Redwood Country Mart, and, you know, people who've never been to that place or don't really know about those people, or I think they feel it in the jewelry. I honestly believe they feel within that piece some sense of the soul of the person who made it and their story. It's kind of, it's held in these materials that they've touched, and, you know, they're kind of... I don't know. I believe
they're a part of it.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Talk to me a little bit about Afghanistan, about Turquoise Mountain.
Turquoise Mountain, Well, Turquoise Mountain is an incredible charity that was started by Prince Charles in 2006.
Okay.
And he partnered with Hamid Karzai, who was then the president of Afghanistan, and Rory Stewart, who's a just an incredibly interesting young man who was in Afghanistan at the time. And the idea is based on, I think, a lot of Prince Charles's ideas about tradition and heritage having a really intrinsic and important part of our lives, as, you know, all our sense of identity, and, you know, with the world where we all move around so much and there's such kind of mixing and melding, but a sense of self comes through, in part, through the material world around you, whether that's the architecture or the food or the craft, the jewelry, the ceramics, the woodwork, whatever it is, especially in these quite traditional communities. This is really important part of our kind of our DNA or our sort of sense of self. And I think especially in areas where there's been so much upheaval in Afghanistan, sort of decades and decades of war, people lose that sense of self. And that's a very, very dangerous thing, I think. You know, our cultural self is really important. And I think he could see that in a country like Afghanistan that has such, you know, deeply spiritual, such incredible, humbling culture and sense of hospitality and sense of the way they are with each other, that this war had destroyed so much. Mm-hmm. And to rebuild old parts of the city and to put in this incredible hand-carved jali work, you know, the wooden work and the lime-wash walls, and to create a school that was so, that is still so beautiful, that these young people who'd been... had grown up with such violence around them, they come in the school and there's just a sense of peace and such a sense of sort of respect when you're in the school, because it's so beautiful and all the details are all obviously kind of natural, you know, woods and natural materials. I see these young people in there just behaving differently towards each other, towards the materials they wear with such respect.
So boys and girls?
Boys and girls. Now, I think it was basically his idea that craft was very important, and obviously in a completely pragmatic way, it's also an income generator. Yeah. And as in most parts of the world, craft is a huge source of support for carpet making or whatever it happens to be. It's an income, and it's an important one, and it's a beautiful one. So I think he saw that, and that's where it started.
Have you always done all these trips by yourself?
Yeah.
Are you ever afraid?
Well, Afghanistan, yes, I used to get quite scared before going. I'd have these sort of slight kind of, and then certainly after I had the twins, I'd have a little anxiety. But the moment I'd land and the moment I'd get in the workshop, it would be just this amazing sort of sense of, they're so welcoming and so thrilled someone had come, you know, made that effort to come. And we just, you know, we'd be talking and about everything under the sun and making the days would pass. And I mean, we had a few incidences in the workshop. There was once an attack outside the workshop, but it was for a minute a little unclear whether it was machine gun or what exactly was happening. And I do remember looking around the workshop and thinking, you know, there's only one entrance and one exit. There's nowhere to hide, because kidnapping was obviously a bit of an issue. And I remember the women I was with, the Afghan women, you know, holding my hand saying, it's okay, we'll protect you if anything happens. And okay. we were fine. But there were certainly moments when there'd be attacks in the city and you'd be a little panicked. But overall, they're welcome there, and they would protect you, you know, no matter what. They're just kind of, I mean, they're still now, so many years later, they're, the relationship, the friendship there is so important to me, above and beyond.
So you mentioned your children. When did you know that it was the right time to have a baby?
We should have worked that way, but I always wanted children. And I think in part, it really came from this traveling around the world and being in places, I mean, the Kalahari, the Himalayas, you know, being in these places of natural beauty and power that I just felt, and meeting these communities and things, I felt this is so important. This is such a huge thing about who we are as people. And I really had this sense I wanted to share this. I wanted to show someone from the next generation, as it were, that, you know, be part of this, see this, maybe having a sense that it's disappearing, or maybe having a sense it's becoming rarer. But I just remember I was, part of wanting to have children was about wanting to share the world, the beauty of the world, you know, this kind of magnificence.
I mean, like your mother had shared with y'all, really. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And so tell me about the journey to having twins.
It was simple. I decided, and it was
not hard at all, was it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, years and years of longing, and that kind of that thing that happens to women in their 20s and 30s when their friends start, you know, marrying and having children. And you're kind of, I don't know, I think I just didn't really understand that that's what you were supposed to. I was in Borneo or where, you know, pursuing other interests, not really knowing you're supposed to like stay still and meet someone and start this. So I was,
you're not supposed to do anything.
You're not supposed to, exactly. No. But I think it was that moment of looking around and saying, you've all done something and I haven't done, I'm not there. I haven't married and had, and kind of, I had lovely relationships and lovely partners, but somehow
you didn't want the same things at the same time.
You didn't want the same things at the same time. Right. And kind of reaching my late 30s and having this sort of, you know, dawning moment that I knew I would find love. That was not my concern. That can happen, you know, 99, that can happen. Wonderful. But I knew having children was a slightly more time sense.
Yes.
So in making that decision of having children on my own was quite... yes, I mean, I think it was a little mix of perhaps sadness that this isn't the way you see other people doing it, but also just kind of thinking my life is somehow not being the way others is
right.
have gone.
No, I would say
and
that.
This is probably, that's, yeah, this seems kind of right.
Yeah.
That's carrying on that way of doing it a different way. And I think from the moment the twins were born, I have been... I can't say I've been happy every minute, but you know, it's just, it's brought so much gratitude. Number one, that is something that I am so conscious of daily, that they're in my life, and absolute joy. So it's kind of been a nearly 10 years of absolute wonder to have them and gratitude. I think when you get that close to facing not having children potentially, and I was 43 when they were born, I think. So it was close.
And it was challenging, the process.
A challenging process. And
also surprising process to have twins.
Yes.
To want a baby and get two.
Yes. Which couldn't have been more perfect. I remember telling someone after the first scan and them going, oh my God. And I just was, because I have twin sister and brother. My sister has twins. Uh-huh. I've been around twins all my life. And I know what a joy that is.
Yeah, it's such a joy. It's two. And my cousins are twins.
And subsequently, with all this travel and things, they always have each other. So for in India, they've got each other. You know, it's always meant that there's someone who's always there, who's your age, who understands a partner in crime.
And how did having children change the way you went about your business, or did it?
Well, interestingly, I suppose because the way it happened, I remember, I mean, I still to this day find it surprising when people tell you in this really kind of boding way that you'd have no idea how your life is going to change in this way of almost.
It's so rude. I know they say it all the time.
I don't understand. It's as if it's warning you, like, you know, what do you think you're getting into? You have no idea. And instead of being, you know, that your life is about to change in the most wonderful way, it changed, but I just feel like it got better. It was enhanced. Yes. It became, you know, all my dreams were fulfilled. Everything I'd ever wanted was now mine. Yeah. And it was kind of, it was better. And did it change in the sense of, yes, I found a succession of lovely nannies who travel with us, mm-hmm. when I'm working and you know, the children are being cared for. But I was very conscious, I, you know, financially have to support myself, the business has to support me, and I have to work, and I also love it. Yeah. I love it. It's so fulfilling. So the fact that they maybe have to travel with me,
Do they love it as you did?
They do. I'm sure there'll be a day where they'll say, I want to stay with my friends and don't want to go to wherever. But at the moment, they do. Mm. They get incredibly excited and spend weeks packing before we have to go.
Is your mom still?
No.
Did she get to meet them?
No, sadly not.
I think she would be really proud of you.
Yeah, I think so.
What's the next community that you hope to work with?
Gosh, I have a list.
And because of the place and the people, or because of the craft that you...
Always a mixture, both. I mean, like when I started working with the Kuna Indians in Panama, it was because I was fascinated politically how they'd kind of had such a sense of self-determination from quite a long time. And it was sort of politically, why are they so incredibly strong? And then I found they made incredible jewelry. So it can be one way or another, but... I'm really interested in, I've started a project in Colombia with Afro-Colombian communities working with gold panners and goldsmiths. And
tell me a little bit about that. I've heard some bits. It sounds really interesting.
It has a little bit of everything, this project, because it's clean gold. So in terms of extractives, there's no mercury, cyanide, and arsenic. There's no mechanization. There's no destruction on the environment, because the gold is panned in these kind of big wooden bowls, as they did 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, pre-Columbian societies. It's working in the rivers. It's something the women do as usually a part of something. And so they're usually farmers, and this is a kind of side initiative in a way, which I think what was interesting about the project is it's looking at gold in a community. So the Afro-Colombian community who do the panning and the goldsmithing obviously were brought from West Africa as slaves, right, and worked in the gold mines. So already their whole kind of, you know, fate was linked to this material. And then, of course, in freedom and came and they had collective rights to land, to farm, and they started to pan themselves. And this gold has always been this kind of addition to their life. It's something that when a child is born, a gold nugget is placed in the belly button of a child. The midwife is paid with gold, and gold has continued to have all these kind of parts in the rituals of their lives. And of course, gold is you know, has an intrinsic value. And if you have gold, it's a certain amount of security for everything. But it's interesting how gold is also, the gold jewelry they wear is also very much a part of their sense of identity and their sense of heritage and things, especially the designs, which come rooted a little bit in West Africa, a little bit from Spain. And it's kind of an interesting and very distinctive jewelry that they design. And so it's clean gold, and it's working with artisans who've been learning and making jewelry for generations and generations, and it's really part of their culture. So it's a kind of very interesting one to work on, and then create something that's drawn from tradition but with a contemporary feel, so it fits into our world too.
Of all the places you've visited, is there one that feels like your soul's home?
Oh, that's so interesting, because I always sort of search for that one place, yeah. but I then realize it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere takes, you know, I'm there and I learn about the place. I study one before I go. I look at, you know, go to every museum and try and sort of understand its history. And it's kind of each place I feel is that place. Mm. I don't know. It's everywhere.
I love that. And what do you hope for the future of the jewelry industry?
Oh, gosh. The area of ethical jewelry has been so interesting because I think it had a very slow and difficult start. There were moves around diamonds that I think were very easy for people to understand, a conflict diamond. I mean, ethical jewelry to me is about looking at the sourcing of the materials. So mining, basically. Mm-hmm. How are they mining? Where are they mining? Who's mining? And how much they're being paid for what they're right. mining? There are certain standards in place like Fair Trade and Fair Mind, which are certifications audited by outside bodies to ensure that there's no children working, that the mercury is contained, that, you know, there's certain standards that we can look at and believe in. And I've visited many mines, both in East Africa and South America, to see how that impacts the community around and so forth. So that's kind of the extractive side. And then there's the making side. Who is making where? Mm-hmm. Why? How much are they being paid? And what are the conditions like that they're working right. in? I think there's such a long way to go. And unfortunately, none of us are able to stand there and say we're fully ethical jewelers because, right. you know, every right. alloy element is kind of, you know, there's not transparency. So many of the stones I work that I get in India, they come from Africa, but nobody knows where right. in Africa, which mine. Or so it's kind of the places I know, like in Afghanistan, like in Myanmar, in Colombia, in Bolivia, certain projects I know. I've been to the mines where we get the gems, and I've been to the gold mines, and I'm happy to say I'm okay with the way those companies are working, or families. Actually, a lot right. of the mines are family run. In India, there isn't yet a certification for recycled gold. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the gems, it is a huge business, and it's very difficult to know where. And, you know, so many of these, you know, rock crystal or labradorite, it's not a stone of enough value to warrant the kind right. of an investment to follow them. So there's so many gems we use that we don't know. And of course, rubies, emeralds, diamonds now have some traceability, but the others very little. So it's something that I look at as working. To me, it's important in the sense of working with communities where I know that A, the job is really important. B, that the materials we're using, we can trace and we know where they're from and we're okay with it. They're not sustainable, but I think, you know, if they've right. been, if the people working in the mines are being paid well, if it's safe and if we're comfortable with what's going on, okay. But I guess in my situation, I think it's important to see a sense of continuation of traditional skills and pride and sense of design, which is part of a sort of tangible heritage, to see that that's kind of continued with the people who are making, and then to help tell their story outside, I guess.
Well, I think the telling of the story part is a really big part of it.
Yeah.
Because yeah. I don't know that. I think the client would care if they really had heard the story well yeah, and understood yeah. it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just don't think that's been done well at all. Yeah. And I don't know what the answer is on that.
I don't know, because social media is there, but you have your 20 seconds. Yeah, exactly. Your website's there, but who's going to read all this? And it is a yeah, difficult exactly. one. Yeah. I think little films are quite good because, you know, if yeah. you can visually explain where someone is and what the landscape's like and what the people are like and hear their language and see their hands, you know, that's yeah. a start. But it's tricky. It's challenging because they're big stories and they're important to get right. And therefore, speeding it up into 20 seconds feels.
Well, you may get back to your documentary filmmaking. Yes. Pippa, how did you get to the Brentwood Country Mart?
Oh, the Brentwood Country Mart. Well, I opened a shop in London, in Notting Hill, maybe in 2006 or something. And in 2008, we decided to open in America. And at first I was thinking New York, but then I met Jim.
Yeah. And in your store in London?
Or we here? Met through mutual friends in London. Yeah, yeah. exactly. And I remember him explaining over dinner all about, and I'd never been to LA, and I just couldn't make any sense in right, my mind exactly. of what he was saying at all. But I thought, okay, I don't know where Santa Monica is or what that, but anyway. And then I met Marsha, who runs our shop, and yeah. Marsha's been, she worked with me in London, and she was a huge influence because she lived in LA, she yeah. had a shop in LA, and she was going to come back. So it made absolute sense. And I remember when we were talking the other day about this because of talking with you about how when she was looking around in 2008 for a space that she thought would be right, and she liked the Third Street, and she was, you know, she was looking at different places, and she came to the Mart to feel, you know, just hang around and feel what it, who's here, what's, and she said she was wondering, it was such a responsibility to be, you know, coming to check for someone else to open someone else's shop, and she kept saying, I hope I get a sign while I'm here to see, you know, that this makes, this is the right spot. And she was sitting on one of the benches, and she said, she's sort of thinking like, how do I know? And how will I tell? And she looked up and she saw Julie Andrews, and Julie Andrews looked at her and said, good morning, dear. And kind of walked off. And she said, it was like Mary Poppins said, yes, this is the one.
That was the best story. Oh my God, I love that so much. That is awesome.
So she hasn't seen her since, but that moment she kind of endorsed it.
Pippa, I know you were in Scotland at the time, and maybe it would have happened if you were in Canada, but we ask everybody on the podcast what they wore to the prom. So I don't think you had a prom.
I'm not even sure what a prom is. Is that when you finish,
it's a promenade,
when you graduate, or
it's your last year of high school before university.
Oh no.
And you have it's a formal. Do you have a favorite formal dress? Do you have something that you have a favorite piece of jewelry?
Okay, that would be good. Okay. Because I was at an old girls' school. Did we have any sort of, and no, there was not that I can recall, nothing like that.
Do you remember your favorite dress from that time?
No.
Did you have to wear a uniform?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, so you had no dresses. Okay.
No, that was fine. Favorite piece of jewelry. That's more difficult. Okay. Well, I mean, I have been wearing this shell
that's
on my arm.
So beautiful.
Since I was about 22 or 23.
Really?
And it's from Nagaland, which is an area, a tribal area between India and Burma.
Okay.
Up in the mountains. And I worked for a Naga human rights activist. He was sort of my mentor for years. I worked with him. He was a refugee in Thailand on a kind of human rights project. And he couldn't go home to India. But at one point, I got permission to go to his area. You needed a special permit because there is sort of conflict as this particular community are trying to get independence from India. So there was a lot of army and guerrilla movements going on. Anyway, I got permission to go, and I went to meet his mother and his sisters and brothers, because I worked with them for quite a long time. I used to hear endless stories about this village and everything from, you know, people's cows and the dog and his neighbors and the cousins. I knew everything about it. But I finally got to go. And they're just a very particular people, the Nagas. They're famous for being, in the past, they were headhunters. So yes, there was quite a lot of warfare going on, but amazingly interesting and incredible community. Huh. Rice farmers now. And so I got there. He didn't get back at the time, but it comes from that community.
And it's a conch.
It's a huge shell.
A huge conch. And does it come off?
No.
You've had it on since you were 22, 23.
Are
you kidding?
Yeah.
And it hasn't broken?
No, it's very thick. And I took it off with great difficulty before I had the twins.
Right.
Because I was a bit concerned.
Yeah.
And then I just have absolutely, I mean, I genuinely have no memory, but I remember it was on a table and I'd be kind of back and forth, new babies, da da da. And then one day I woke up and it was back on, and I must have in the night got up and like struggled and put it back on, and with no memory, because it's quite a thing. But
it's so beautiful.
It's obviously kind of, I mean, in some ways I see it as my shell. Like when I feel shy, I can disappear in it. And sometimes people kind of meet me and they say, oh, you're the girl with the shell. Like they don't remember me at all, but they remember the shell. So it's kind of now a bit part of me. But, and in other ways, it's, I think of it as, yeah, it's protection. But it reminds me of them and him. And he was such an influence in my life. So.
And sounds like he was so generous. And,
yes. Yeah. Yes. Amazing.
Is it comfortable?
Person.
I guess it must be.
I don't
be.
Notice it.
I don't
know. But I mean, it, you know, you can, like, you can't wear tight-sleeved things.
No, I was thinking that. I was actually thinking that about when you said that.
Yeah.
I was thinking you must have to think about all of your shirts.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow.
There's things that you know, desperately want to wear, and you put them on and they just won't go over the shell. So that's that.
Do you sleep in your jewelry?
Yeah.
Everything.
Do you take out my earrings every night?
Wow. It's so beautiful.
But even my rings now, I don't take off. I used to take rings on. No, so I leave it all on.
It's too much trouble.
Yeah. I like it. I like having them
they
in
sound,
the bath,
they sound
in the
so beautiful. You sound like a little twinkling.
Yeah, there are little bells and things on here. So
it's
been a racket.
Pippa, this has been such a treat. Thank you so much. Speaking of generous, you've been so generous with your time. And thanks for spending your time with me.
I'm truly honored. Thank you.
Thanks. What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting,
was composed and performed by Britt Drasda. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.